Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in from the snow and the wind and the cold. Hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and warm yourself by the fire. You are among friends. Welcome to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett, and we're coming to you live from Coast's Toronto affiliate Talk Radio AM 640, where, admittedly, it is unseasonably warm, but I know many of you are facing incredible difficulties due to the winter weather. A blizzard with gale-force winds paralyzed the southern and eastern United States, dumping snow as millions hunkered down at home, hoping their food supplies would last and the power would not go out. Seven states declared states of emergency as part of the U.S. Capitol were blanketed with nearly 60 centimeters of drifting snow. At least 18 deaths have been reported and blamed on the weather, most from traffic accidents. One person died in Maryland while shoveling snow. The declarations were issued for Tennessee, North Carolina, Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania, Washington, D.C., New Jersey, New York, and parts of other states. About 85 million people are in the storm's path. Utilities bracing for possible mass outages as the storm system moves northeastward. The U.S. National Weather Service said the winter storm could rank near the top 10 ever to hit the region. Wherever you are tonight, I pray you are safe and warm and dry. Meanwhile, we do have the first full moon of 2016 tonight, and so it's a great time to hunker down, batten down the hatches, stay indoors, and listen to Coast AM. Coming up in hours 2, 3, and 4 of the program, my guest teaches an honors course at Texas State University called Demonology, Possession, and Exorcism. He says it's no bird course. His students produce research papers on topics that range from the role of sleep paralysis in reports of demonic attacks to contemporary murder cases in which defendants have claimed supernatural forces compelled them to commit crimes. In fact, talk of demons isn't unusual in Texas. The first day of class, they watched a clip of an alleged exorcism at an Austin Starbucks. Many of his students said they'd seen similar scenes in towns where they'd grown up. In 2014, an exorcism took place outside of a Starbucks in Austin, Texas. A few students even admitted their parents were nervous that they'd signed up for the class. Perhaps these parents worried their kids would become possessed, or that studying possession in the classroom might make demons seem less plausible. Either way, these parents aren't a superstitious minority. A poll conducted in 2012 found that 57% of Americans believe in demonic possession. Nonetheless, demons, invisible malevolent spirits, and exorcism, the techniques used to cast these spirits out of people, objects, or places, are often thought of as relics of the past, beliefs and practices that are incompatible with modernity. It's an assumption based in a sociological theory that dates back to the 19th century called the secularization narrative. Scholars such as Max Weber predicted that over time science would inevitably supersede belief in mysterious forces. But while the influences of institutionalized churches has waned, few sociologists today would claim that science is eliminating belief in the supernatural. In fact, in the 40 years since the blockbuster film The Exorcist premiered, belief in the demonic remains as popular as ever, with many churches scrambling to adapt. We'll find out, why do we appear to be living in exorcisms golden age? Coming up in hour one, claims of corruption in professional sport is nothing new. Any casual fan of professional baseball are well acquainted with the sordid details of the 1919 Black Sox scandal, where the Chicago White Sox threw the World Series to the Cincinnati Reds. Claims of corruption in professional boxing are also quite common. But what about the highfalutin sport of professional tennis? Say it ain't so. Recently, the BBC conducted an investigation along with BuzzFeed News, and they claimed an unnamed Grand Slam winner was under suspicion for throwing matches. They say they have a cache of documents stretching back to 2007 that expose widespread suspected match-fixing at the top level of world tennis, including Wimbledon. Lucifer serving Love 40. We'll talk with Brian Tuohy about corruption in professional tennis when Coast to Coast AM continues right after this. Brian Tuohy is recognized as America's leading expert on game fixing in sports. He's the author of three nonfiction books on sports corruption, The Fix Is In, Larceny Games, and A Season in the Abyss, and another, Disaster Government, on national emergencies and continuity of government programs. He's written for Sports Illustrated, Vice Sports, Sports on Earth, and Bleacher Report, among others, as well as on his own website, thefixisin.net. Brian Tuohy, welcome to Coast to Coast. How are you, my friend?
Fine. How are you doing tonight, Richard?
Very well. My word, professional tennis, say it ain't so. I mean, is it just me, or, you know, many of us, I think, for some reason, think that tennis is a little bit different, maybe than some of the other sports, and that it's supposed to be above this sort of thing, fixing and corruption. I mean, is this something that caught you by surprise, this BBC BuzzFeed News report investigation, or was it basically, for you, suspicions confirmed?
Yeah, it was nothing surprising to me, and I think if anybody had taken a look at the original report that the Tennis Investigative Unit, or Tennis Integrity Unit, I should say, actually, did back in 2007, you could see that there was probably more going on than, you know, most people were led to believe. And even, you know, not to hype somebody else's book on a radio show, but there was a gentleman by the name of Michael Mushaw who wrote a book called Short Circuit back in, like, 1983, I believe. And in that, he, you know, detailed elements of match fixing and tanking in professional tennis, you know, 30-some-odd years ago. So, I mean, it's nothing really new. It's just, unfortunately, it's come to the surface yet again.
Djokovic, Novak Djokovic, the Joker, recently spoke in depth for the first time, and he said that he was offered $200,000 to fix a match. This is going back 10 years ago. Now, Roger Federer, arguably the game's most venerated player, called this latest allegation to be, which was recently aired on the BBC, he said it's far-fetched. So we have, you know, two of the top players. We have Djokovic on the one hand saying that he was offered money a decade ago. We have Federer on the other saying this is ridiculous. How do we make sense of this?
Well, I was going to say it's far-fetched if you've never been approached. You know, if you're living a clean life and no one ever comes after you with, you know, such tales of corruption or ideas of it, then you would obviously think, you know, someone else is making it up. But I think, you know, other people inside tennis realize this is a problem because tennis is the second most gambled upon sport worldwide. I mean, more than the NFL, Major League Baseball, tennis is number two right behind soccer. And with that much money involved and a lot of illegal wagering going on in the Far East and in other places in Europe and even in America, you know, there's a lot of mobsters involved in this, a lot of organized crime, and there's a lot of people with a lot of money who are going to use whatever means they can to make more money. And when you have, you know, tennis players, and they've done research, you know, tennis players, the touring pros, very few actually make a profit. So when you have touring pros who are losing money trying to be on the tour, trying to make something of themselves, they can see a real good benefit in throwing matches for a few thousand dollars because it'll keep their dreams alive and it'll keep them going. And it's nothing really, it shouldn't be anything shocking to the people involved.
But we're not talking about the players on the lower rungs here. We are talking about top seeds, are we not?
Well, it's a little of both. I mean, the problem is because of what the BBC and BuzzFeed released, we don't know the names, although there are bloggers who believe they've uncovered basically the 15, 16 players that BuzzFeed and the BBC kind of fingered through their own studies. There are players at all different levels that could be involved. And the thing is a lot of people think, you know, just because the player's at the top of their game, if they think even, you know, a great NFL player, Major League Baseball player, you know, you can't get to them because they make millions of dollars. Well, the fact of the matter is these athletes are people. And these are people who can have problems, who can have gambling problems of their own, who could have drug problems, who could have all sorts of things that can influence, you know, their lives. And if anything, we've learned from the mafia over the course of the past 100-some-odd years is the fact that organized crime knows how to get to these people how to exploit those weaknesses and profit off of them.
Now, would these gambling syndicates, and I believe they talked about Russian syndicates, they talked about Italian syndicates, would they be approaching the players themselves, or would they be approaching the support teams behind the players, like trainers, or do we know that even?
You know, they didn't really specify that, but from my research and what I've seen from FBI files related to Major League Baseball and the NFL and the NCAA and things of that nature, is that approaches can take on many different forms. So, I mean, it can be a very direct, immediate approach to an athlete. It can be kind of more of a, you know, end around in a way, if you will, to get to that athlete. I mean, there's different ways of doing it, and it's just a matter of what works best. I mean, in many ways, this is a kind of a crime of opportunity, but the fact is, the way athletes are today, there's plenty of opportunities to exploit.
And how would this work exactly? Assuming that someone from the mob went to a trainer or a player directly. Do they tell them? How does it work? Do they blackmail them? Do they tell them you've got to throw this match, or you're going to be injured and you're going to forfeit this match? How does it work in terms of the research that you've done?
Well, like I say, it takes many forms. So I mean, it could be just a greed and a money thing. It could be that an athlete is in need of money. You know, like we mentioned with tennis, you know, it could be that they're on the tour, they're struggling to make ends meet, and so they need some money. Somebody makes the approach to them to give them money, and they do this for money. And that's the same, I think, with college sports here in America, is that, you know, you have these unpaid athletes, and they're very easy to exploit. They can see, you know, their coach making $3 million a year. They can see the stadiums filled with fans, and, you know, they're not seeing anything besides supposedly a free scholarship. And someone comes along and says, hey, look, we'll give you $10,000, just shave a few points. And it seems like a good idea at the time. And, you know, there have been studies by the NCAA that have proven that athletes have done this and gotten away with it. And so, you know, that's one way to do it. Or there's, you know, like, say, a gambling athlete gets in trouble with his bookie. And, you know, there's kind of a history of this, too, where they can't pay up, even though they're supposedly making all this money. They've bet more than they can afford to lose. And suddenly they're in trouble, and the bookie says, look, I'll wipe away this debt if you do something for me. And, you know, once you get your hooks into somebody, it takes off from there. And I mean, in another way is that there was a, you know, FBI article or FBI file I dug up that became a New York Post article in which, you know, New York members of the New York Knicks were accused of throwing games, shaving points for a cocaine dealer just, you know, as a friendly thing to do for them. So there's many, many different ways of getting at this and getting at players and getting at referees to do things that most people think just doesn't happen.
But if you're playing on a team sport and you can only get to one player on in basketball or in soccer, for example, it would be far more difficult to manipulate the outcome. But if you're talking about professional tennis and you get to the player and you say, throw this match, you know, not unlike any other individual sport like boxing, for example, I mean, it's pretty easy, you know, obviously to influence the outcome. If it's just an individual sport, correct?
Well, exactly. If it's a, you know, you only got the one guy, once you have them in your pocket, then you have the match. And the tricky thing with tennis is because they allow in-game wagering in many places in Europe, and that's where a lot of this tennis fixing comes from, is the fact that they don't have to fix the match. They don't have to fix who wins or who loses. They can actually just have a player throw a single set in the match. They can have them throw just a single game within a set. Because you can bet within the game, and you can bet on these in-game occurrences, it makes it, A, really hard to catch, because if somebody loses a game, you know, it happens all the time. Even the best in the world lose a game. They can even lose a set, but yet they can go on to win the match. So how do you prove that they threw that single set or that single game? So, I mean, that's become the trick with tennis, is that there's so many opportunities to bet on it. It opens up a lot of opportunities to fix an element within that match. So it makes it really hard to investigate, it makes it really hard to prove, and it makes it really easy to get away with.
In other words, you don't have to throw the match, you can just throw a couple of games
exactly.
In a set.
And they've seen it in other sports too. I mean, they've seen it in soccer, they've seen it in cricket, where they don't have to throw a match, but they can just, you know, in soccer you can bet on who does the first penalty, you know, who has the first corner kick, who has the first throw-in. You know, you can do it in cricket on the balls and that sort of thing. I mean, you can do just these little in-game elements, and it's still fixing, but it's not really affecting the outcome. And that's why it makes it very opportune for these people to be involved in it, because they don't have to throw an entire game. They just have to cause one event to happen, and then they're free to move on.
It seems to me that the various governing bodies of professional tennis, not surprisingly, are not interested in this investigation going forward. Are they literally throwing obstacles in the way? Are they cooperating with the investigation? Are they ignoring the findings? What's going on?
Well, the problem is tennis is investigating tennis. And, I mean, would you allow Goldman Sachs to investigate Goldman Sachs for insider trading? Or would you allow, you know, Exxon to investigate Exxon over some environmental violations? You know, I don't think you would. But that's what we have going on here, is tennis is investigating tennis. And you've seen this, you know, here in America, too, where the NFL investigates the NFL. Major League Baseball investigates itself. And while they do have former members of law enforcement, people who know how to investigate these things on their security and investigative departments, the problem is there's no outside oversight. So if tennis finds something out, and that's what these BBC and BuzzFeed documents kind of show, is that if they find something out, they don't have to make it public. They can keep it internal, and they can keep it quiet and hope it never blows up in the media, which obviously backfired for tennis in this case. But, you know, that's what has happened with all these sports, is they're allowed to investigate themselves, and yet their investigators have no actual police powers. So, you know, how much investigation can really be done? How much dirt can they really dig up if they're not really police and they're not outside of these, you know, basically big businesses that are running these sports?
Now, shaving some points or throwing a game here or there is one thing. But are we talking about, for example, the outcome of a Grand Slam event being fixed here? Or again, is it just sort of the lower rungs in terms of the seeds, maybe throwing a game here or there? Or is it a question of, you know, a significant match at the higher echelons of the sport, top seeds throwing matches in a Grand Slam?
Well, the problem is you can't rule out any of it now, because it could be anywhere, it could be everywhere. It could be more invasive than we think. It could be less invasive than things seem to indicate. But that's the problem, is who's looking for it and who's digging it up and who's going to really find out what's going on? Because I don't think tennis is, and I don't really know if the sports media is going to do it either. So the problem with tennis is it's more likely to be going on with the lower seeds, because those are people more in need of money. But to rule out the fact that some Grand Slam event couldn't be fixed, you couldn't figure out and fix who's going to be the champion, I think is absurd, because you look at other sports like boxing, you know, we've known they fixed championship fights. You know, we've known the organized crime has fixed games in the World Cup, the biggest soccer match in the world. You know, we know matches have been fixed at that level. So if they can get to those things, then nothing is really safe or sacred.
And yet, well, you're right. We do know that these things go on. We know it goes on in professional boxing, professional soccer, amateur soccer. In the past, of course, we've had, you know, I mentioned earlier the 1919 Black Sox incident. It doesn't seem to matter at a certain level. You know, people continue to bet on sports. People continue to follow these sports. I mean, does it matter?
No, I don't think so. I mean, if, on one level, you got to remember, sports are entertainment. And that's really, you know, the NFL, despite being called football or being called a game, it's entertainment, and they've admitted as such, as it's just being entertainment. So people are betting on an entertainment, you know, avenue. That's all it is. But they're gambling on it because they're watching it. And with so much money being gambled on it, there's so much illegal money being gambled on these sports. No one has an idea really how much money is involved in the gambling industry, especially the illegal market, which in the United States is probably 99% of the money being wagered. So, you know, we have literally billions of dollars swirling around out there that nobody's watching, nobody's monitoring, and there's no oversight on it. So, I mean, we have no idea really how deep the rabbit hole here can go, and we don't know what people can get away with because, again, nobody's looking out for this thing. Unfortunately, you know, I've done more research and writing on this subject for my little office here in Wisconsin than like the entirety of ESPN has. And that, I think, is a frightening aspect when you think about it all.
Brian Toohey, recognized as America's leading expert on game fixing in sports, and we're talking about recent allegations about game fixing in professional tennis. We'll take a time out, come back, and continue to delve into this controversial subject right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett. Don't go away. That's right, and we will take calls, questions, and comments for Brian Tuohy, recognized as America's leading expert on game fixing in sports. He is taking on the state religion, No Sacred Cows. The author of three nonfiction books on sports corruption, The Fix Is In, Larceny Games, and A Season in the Abyss. The news peg here is, of course, allegations that there is a game fixing in professional tennis, which may or may not come as a surprise to some of you. Doesn't certainly come as a surprise to Brian Tuohy, but we'll get back to that conversation in mere moments. Back with my conversation with Brian Tuohy as we talk corruption in professional sports right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett, coming to you from Coast's affiliate in Toronto, Talk Radio AM 640. Brian Tuohy is with us. The website, thefixisin.net, and three nonfiction books on sports corruption. The Fix Is In, A Season in the Abyss, Sports Gambling Versus the NFL's Integrity, Larceny Games, Sports Gambling, Game Fixing, and the FBI. I'm guessing you're not real popular in the locker room, Brian.
No, I'm not. No, well, you know, and the sad thing is, you know, that's one of the problems with sports media is, you know, there's self-censorship. You know, the beat writers and guys who cover these games and sports every day, if they write the wrong story, if they publish the wrong story, they can lose their access to the locker room, to the players, to the coach. And if you lose that access, well, then how are you going to do your job? You basically unemploy yourself. So that's a real issue with the sports media, that and the fact that, of course, the sports media funds professional sports in America. So, I mean, there's really, it's kind of a conflict of interest because they're supposed to be our watchdog, but really they're partners.
Sure. It's like the White House press corps. You get your credentials from the Secret Service. If you ask an embarrassing question during a press conference and you don't get called upon ever again, you're useless to your news outlet, and that's the Fur-Line trap. It's nothing so overt as an editor saying, don't ask that question, don't go there, don't write that story, but you know where you're, you know, what side your bread is buttered on.
Well, exactly, and that's, like I say, that's one of the things I think a lot of fans seem to like what I do and what I write about, is because I'm not beholden to ESPN or Fox Sports or any of these major media, you know, conglomerates. I'm on my own, doing my own thing, and writing about a subject that they don't want to cover.
So, but you must at the same time be a sports fan. So how does that affect the way you watch professional sports, if you know that in many cases, you know, the fix is in? For example, we have the Super Bowl coming up. We've got the AFC, the Broncos versus the Pats. On the NFC side, we've got the Panthers and the Cards. I mean, can you even enjoy those games and watch those games knowing what you know about corruption in professional sports?
No, not really. I mean, because I watch them from a totally different angle, and I don't really watch sports by any means the way I used to. And the thing is, and what I try to educate fans about is, look, these are entertainment industries now. That's what the NFL is. That's what Major League Baseball is, the NBA, all of it. It's an entertainment industry. They've argued this fact in court. And because of that, because before these games that's going to be on television tomorrow, they're going to say the following is a presentation of the National Football League. Well, what does presentation mean? It means it's a presentation. It means it's entertainment. And because of that, which a lot of people won't believe and they'll attack me for, is the leagues, like the NFL, can literally manipulate, fix, whatever you want to call it, their own games for entertainment purposes. They can have their employees manipulate the outcomes of these games and do so perfectly legally. It's not breaking any law by the league fixing its own game. If a gambler tried to influence a game, well, that's breaking the Sports Bribery Act. That's a federal offense. But if a league actually manipulates its own game, that's not a crime. So if the NFL wants Peyton Manning to win the Super Bowl this year, they can actually force that into being, and fans can have no recourse.
How do you keep something like that, though, under wraps? It's not like tennis, where it's, maybe one mobster approaches one low-seeded tennis player. Here you've got 50-plus players on a football team. How do you keep something like that secret if it's being scripted, not necessarily by the mob, but by the league itself?
Well, because you don't need everybody. As one gambler once said, you give me three players. You give me a quarterback, an offensive lineman, and a defensive back on a team, and I can give you any football game you want. That's all you need, three guys. And if you have a referee that can throw a flag or not throw a flag in certain situations, that can control the outcome of a game. I mean, when you're watching the game at home and you see something on your big screen TV where, like, for example, a player is out of bounds or a goal is clearly scored, and then the referee comes back out and says, no, that didn't happen. Well, how is that possible? And that's what I think it comes down to, is the fact is not necessarily are the referees making the correct call, but they're making the right call. And by that, I mean they're making the call that most benefits the league. And that's what it is. These are employees. They get paid by the league, and they will do what the league wants them to do. Now, I don't think, again, you have to have everybody involved. You don't need all 53 guys on one team to tank a game. You just need one or two. And the same way that organized crime has been able to get their hooks into players in all of these different sports around the world, those are the same tools that really a league could use with their security networks, that they have in place that can find out all the dirt on these players. And they can use it to basically blackmail or put these guys up against the wall and get them to do what needs to be done. It's, throw one game, but yet have a 10-year career and make $100 million.
Are you telling me, Brian, that the NFL, for example, has its own secret police?
Yes, they have what's called NFL security. All the major leagues have these things. And the NFL is literally staffed with former members of the CIA, FBI, Secret Service, local law enforcement, and these guys, and I've interviewed Warren Welsh, who's the former head of NFL security, for a couple of my books. These guys exist, I really believe, to keep things quiet, because I cannot find, and I've been researching this stuff for over 10 years now, I cannot find a single example of any professional league, baseball, football, you name it, where the FBI or local law enforcement has arrested a player, a coach, or a referee for some, crime or whatever, and thanked the security division for helping them assist in this. That never has happened. So it's all about the league. Like I said before, it's like tennis investigating itself, the NFL investigating itself. Do you really think they're going to put their dirt out into the public if no one else is looking for it? Of course not.
I'm here in Toronto, and we have not had a Stanley Cup, as you well know, in Toronto since 1967. We came close back in the early 90s. We almost made it to the semifinals, and we were playing Los Angeles, and a late penalty call and so forth. And there have been claims. You have to consider the source. We're long-suffering, bitter hockey fans, but there have been claims that the NHL didn't want a Canadian team in the Stanley Cup final or in Major League Baseball. They didn't want the Blue Jays in the World Series. Are we just, is this sour grapes, or may we be on to something here?
Well, obviously, that's always the cry of the loser, especially the losing gambler as well. It was fixed, and that's why I lost. Unfortunately, it just sounds like sour grapes. You're right. But at the same time, if you look at these leagues as a business, now the NHL, for example, it has fans in Canada. It doesn't need more fans in Canada. Where it needs fans is in the United States, and where the NHL has expanded in recent years has been in the southern United States. So that's where it needs to build up a fan base. And lo and behold, some of these southern teams, when teams move, like when the Whalers moved to Carolina, oh, they won a Stanley Cup. And when Quebec moved to, become the Colorado Avalanche, oh, they won a Stanley Cup. When the North Stars moved out of Minnesota down to Texas, oh, they won a Stanley Cup. Isn't that convenient? Well, that would be a good business decision for the NHL to make those things happen, because that's going to gain more fans in the needed fan base and generate more revenue for the league. And that's why I think fans have to start looking at these things like a business, because that's what they are. And if they can manipulate these things to make more revenue, make more profit, get higher TV ratings, create more advertising, why wouldn't they do it, especially if there's no law being broken in doing so?
But are you suggesting that Major League Baseball, basketball, football, hockey, perhaps tennis. I mean, has it gotten to the point where it is as orchestrated in some cases as, let's say, for example, professional wrestling, which is entirely fake?
Well, I don't think it's gotten that far. I think this is a good tool that the leagues can use. I don't think every game is fixed. I don't think it's all scripted, every play, everything like that. But I think this is a tool that when they see certain storylines, when they see certain athletes come to the forefront, that they can use it to push those agendas further along. And again, it's all about profitability and making more money. And that's what I think, again, I try to, tell people, this is what you need to look out for. If you look at a game and a sport with that eye in mind, with that, take off your fan hat and look at it as a business and what's best for the business, which outcome would benefit the business the best, and then you start seeing the ball always bounce the league's way. Well, how many times can that be? There's only so much luck involved in these sports. There's supposed to be some skill and there's supposed to be more to it than just that, but yet it always seems to go the league's way, and I think that's because it's the best business decision to make at times.
All right, I'm guessing you're not getting invited to any Super Bowl parties, Brian.
No, people usually say I ruin sports for them. And that's fine, because again, I don't want people to live and die by their team. I live in Wisconsin and there's a lot of Packer fans, and you can literally feel the state be depressed when the Packers lose. I mean, it affects people that much. And the leagues know this, unfortunately. They know that fans in many ways are addicted, and they've done studies where it's almost like a drug for them. So, you have to ask yourself, well, why do you care so much about this team or these players, especially if you have no real contact with them? You don't know these guys. They're not family members. So why do you care if they win or lose? And I mean, that's what gets to me is I just want fans to be more educated and more, rational about these sports and look at them as simply entertainment. If you want to watch, fine, I don't mind. But watch with an educated eye.
All right, let's grab a few calls here while time permits. On the east of the Rockies line, Steve is in Illinois. Steve, welcome to Coast AM. Go ahead.
Thank you very kindly. I've suspected long in tennis what's going on to be going on. And week after week, collegiate and professional football, they're always within 7 points of one another. They keep the fans glued, their revenue coming in from the commercials. And baseball, you'll watch a pitcher start getting so sloppy throwing dirt balls and all kinds of things going on there. I mean, it's so obvious. They're almost getting points in baseball now like football. And the last one is, Brian, and I'm glad to talk to you, and thank you, Richard, is Pete Carroll, last year's Super Bowl. Now, if people don't realize that he threw that game, making that stupid call, they call it the worst call in football's history, I don't know what it would take for him. And I'll take the answer off the phone. I thank you very kindly, Brian, for your work.
All right, Steve, thank you for the call. Brian, go ahead. Your thoughts on the Pete Carroll call.
Well, here's the thing, and I appreciate Steve as well for calling and asking the question, is proving that these things are fixed is something completely different than accusing things of being fixed. And in all the FBI files that I obtained, and I obtained over 400 of them, every file the FBI had related to the subject matter, the FBI had a very hard time, if basically never could, prove that certain games are fixed, even if they had good, very good information from what they called the upper echelon informants, providing them this stuff that something indeed was fixed, even if they knew this player was supposedly working with this bookie to fix this game, and that's exactly what happened. It didn't prove the game was fixed. Every player has a bad game. Every referee can screw up. Every coach can make a bad call, and then you want to say instantly, well, it is fixed. Well, it doesn't mean it was, but it's a good starting point, and it's the same with tennis. They did this investigation. They followed the betting patterns, and they saw all these suspected matches. Well, that doesn't mean for sure that those matches were fixed, but again, it's a good place to start from. And even like with that Pete Carroll call is really suspect, it doesn't mean it was fixed, but at the same time, you can't necessarily rule out that it wasn't.
What about Pete Rose, Major League Baseball, betting on baseball games while he was a player manager with the Reds? And if that were true, wouldn't Major League Baseball be wise to keep Pete Rose silent, allow him into the Hall of Fame, and just say, Pete, just don't talk about it? But now the cat is out of the bag.
Well, the problem with Rose, too, is, and a lot of people don't know this, they investigated him actually as a player back in the late 60s and early 70s for betting on baseball.
That long ago?
Yeah, and they couldn't prove it then, and they kind of let it lapse. And when they went to reinvestigate him in the 80s when he was a manager, they actually destroyed all the old files. So I talked to John Dowd, the guy who led the investigation, and he said, yeah, they got rid of all those old investigations on Rose. So, I mean, Rose, unfortunately, he's an addicted gambler. He has a problem, and it's surprising that no other athlete supposedly since him has had that same issue, despite the fact that athletes and gamblers share many of the same character traits. To myself, I don't think Rose should be allowed in the Hall of Fame ever, and I know they're putting him in the Cincinnati Reds Hall of Fame, which is, I think, ridiculous despite his popularity, because, look, if you want to keep the integrity of the game the way these leagues claim that they want, you can't let a guy like Rose continue to get accolades. Because even though he was supposedly just betting on his own team, he was manipulating his own team to win his bets. And when he didn't bet on the Reds, he was actually giving inside information to the bookies he was working on to bet on the other team. So he was actually manipulating games, and he was giving information to organized crime and gamblers by doing what he was doing. And that doesn't deserve to be recognized with a Hall of Fame, you know, ballot.
Very quickly, James on the wild card line in Philadelphia. Quick question, please.
Yes, okay, Mr. Chewy, two quick questions about two individuals. First, the piece on, have you heard anything about the Billie Jean King Bobby Riggs match supposedly being fixed? Because I saw the piece that they did on ESPN a couple of years ago, and that had ramifications, because that match literally helped women, you know, with sports, with Title IX. Do you give any credence to that match being fixed? I do, because he beat Margaret Court fairly handily a year earlier, and yet he loses to Billie Jean King. What have you heard about the Bobby Riggs Billie Jean King match? And then the second question is, have you ever heard any rumors around Ollie Liston, any of the two fights there?
The Phantom Ollie Punch. Liston. The Phantom Punch, yes, very quickly.
Well, I believe both the Ali Liston fights were fixed, and I believe Liston took a dive in both of them. Definitely the second one for sure. The FBI investigated actually both of them, and in my opinion, both were rigged for sure. Now with the Bobby Riggs, Billie Jean King thing, I remember that article as well, and I think they did a very good job in showing that Riggs most likely did in fact throw that match to Billie Jean King for his own reasons, and it did have benefits of it, but, you know, it probably wasn't a completely legit match. And in fact, you know, Riggs was a hustler as it was, so for him to throw something like that wouldn't be a shock, I think.
If, in conclusion, Brian, we learn the top-seeded tennis greats were involved, I mean, is this going to be ultimately that damaging to professional tennis, or will people just forgive and forget?
It seems like, in all these sports, it's always a forgive and forget thing. You know, I mean, it's always, oh boy, that was terrible. And then 3 years later, people go, oh yeah, I forgot all about that. And that's.
I agree. Brian, we got to go. But thank you. TheFixIsIn.net. Appreciate it. Back with more Coast to Coast, the golden era of demonic possession. Stay with us.